It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning in. Tomorrow, on the 4th of July, the Ballard Locks turn 100 years old. There'll be a parade there this Sunday recreating that day of triumph when commercial and pleasure boats first moved from the Saltwater Sound through the locks and the Ship Canal and on to freshwater Lake Washington. But triumph is not the whole story of the Ballard Locks. It's also a crushing story. Let's talk about this now with Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes. Linda, good to see you again.
Hi, Bill. It's great to be back.
So we're going to get to who this really affects. First, I just don't want to assume that everybody knows what the Ballard Locks are and how they came to be. What are the Ballard Locks?
So the Ballard Locks are our engineered connection to saltwater from the interior lakes of Seattle. So what we're talking about is Union Bay, Portage Bay, Lake Union, Salmon Bay out to Shoal Bay. This is an 8-mile long corridor, and this connection allows mostly, by the way, pleasure boats to make the trip from freshwater to salt. And, you know, 81% of the vessel traffic today is recreational traffic. That was not the original idea. The idea was commerce. Open up this passage for shipping anything from logs to coal. And it was hoped there'd be a big industrial boom on the shores of Lake Washington.
Factories all along the canal?
Yeah, sure thing. That didn't happen, but of course, creating this engineered channel and setting the lake levels by our control rather than nature allowed much of present-day Seattle's footprint to emerge. For instance, it used to be Lake Washington would drop and go up and down 7 feet during the course of the seasonal year. That doesn't happen anymore. We engineer the lake level today to only a 2-foot change. What does that mean? It means we have 2 floating bridges connecting us to the east side.
Well, if I guess you couldn't have floating bridges if the lake was rising and falling like that.
Makes you think about the future. What if we had a huge seismic event that were to take out the locks? Those bridges could not function. In fact, they would fail. Hmm. And so it's not like the Elwha Dam built out on the Olympic Peninsula in 1910, same time frame. You can't just take out the locks. So much of today's footprint of Seattle depends on the fact of this engineered channel and the presence of the locks. And of course, there's so much development in the shoreline that was created with the dropping of Lake Washington by 9 feet.
Yeah.
So this is, if you were to think of a single action that transformed Seattle, I can't think of anything that tops it. Even the filling of the tide flats at the Duwamish, even the regrade, those things went on for decades. With one action, we really created what is today the footprint of modern Seattle.
Yes. Let's talk about what went into that feat of engineering and the people it affected. Just describe what a feat of engineering that was.
Well, you know, it's pretty spectacular to consider this incredible reroute of the rivers of central Puget Sound, changing of the lake level, altering the hydrologic regime of the lake. Of course, it used to be low in the summer and high in the winter. Not anymore. We plump up the lake level for summer to have plenty of water for lockage. So that's a reversal. It used to be that salmon entered the Duwamish and went up the Black River to get to the south end of Lake Washington.
And the Black River, a river you may never have heard of.
Well, and this is a truly sad fact. So the Black River was a short, beautiful river and a salmon highway. So the salmon coming in the Duwamish cruised through the Black River to get to the high mountains, to the Cedar River, through Lake Washington, through its south end. The Black River used to be the southern drainage for the lake. When we dropped it 9 feet, that's a lot, that literally cut off, choked off, killed the Black River. And for the Duwamish people who were living along the Black River, longhouses all up and down there, all of a sudden, within 3 months, a place that had sustained them for 10,000 years just went away.
But that wasn't a surprise. Did the city consult with the people living and working along these waters?
Sadly not. So if you roll back in time, nobody was asking the native people, was this okay with them? Hardly. I mean, this is actually an even sadder story because this is after the treaty time. This is after the diseases, the dispossessions that had already been going on. And some of the Duwamish people had been pushed out of Seattle and taken up residents along the Black River as a kind of last stand. And then they lost even that. And similarly, in our coverage in the Sunday paper, we showed a picture of Salmon Bay Charlie hanging on in what is present-day Magnolia.
He had a Salmon Bay Charlie is a real man.
He's an actual real person. Yeah. And we have a picture, which Mohai was kind enough to let us use, of him standing in his front yard with his clam basket over his arm as the three white guys show up to let him know it's time to go. You know, the timing of this story, of course, we brought it out now because of the anniversary, the centennial. But I think in Seattle right now, there are a lot of people feeling dispossessed, overrun by all the growth and all the change. I don't even know where my bank is anymore. I don't know where my anything is anymore. And I think to myself, you know, obviously this is nothing compared to what the first people of this place went through. This would be the equivalent of an alien force draining Elliott Bay, taking away all the grocery stores, and while you're at it, close the schools and the places of worship, because these were places of spirit power and instruction and sustenance for 10,000 years.
That's like an apocalypse when you put it that way.
That's the right word.
Yeah.
I wanted people to see the unseen and to make present the absence, to just pull back the frame historically and bring in images, people, places that actually are not gone. They're embedded in the landscape. They're a part of all of our history. And to stand there on the shore of Lake Union, for instance, with Warren King George, historian for the Muckleshoot tribe, and ask him to look at this same place with me as the seaplane is buzzing overhead and the tourists are kayaking by, this place where we'll all watch fireworks in a couple of days. And he would point and say, "That's the place where it was good to put in canoes because it was nice and deep. That's the place where Cougar hopped over the logs to avoid his competitors. That's the place where it was good to gather the cattails for weaving tule mats." You know, that wasn't very long ago. Out here in the Northwest, history is so recent, and it's in some cases hidden in plain sight, and it's good to seek out this history, know this history, and so to go to these places with descendants of the ancestors who went through this apocalyptic change was a rich and evocative privilege, really.
You mentioned that, and the way you said it, that this is mostly pleasure boats that are coming through the locks, not commerce as was the original plan. Is there something wrong with that?
Well, there's an issue, which is funding. Because of the way the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which built, manages, runs the locks, charges for those services, they only charge for commercial tonnage. This means even the fishing boats that come through the locks to snug in, they've already offloaded their catch. They're not paying. The pleasure boats aren't paying. This means the locks are drastically underfunded. This is an unresolved issue. And as we think about the locks in 100 years, there are a couple of things that have got to get figured out. One of them is funding to take care of the locks so that they don't fall apart, and also to improve salmon passage as best as possible in a completely altered system. You know, another thing to talk about is water. So here we are using first use, beautiful mountain water from the Cedar River watershed every time boats want to go through. In the scenario of climate change, is that something we're going to be able to do? Should we at least be charging? Seismic retrofit, how safe are the locks in the event of a dramatic earthquake? That's something to think about. And so there are sustainability issues with regard to the locks in addition to the environmental justice issues that we raised in our story.
Okay, so I wonder, though, if I read you wrong, if I read your face wrong, when you said that this is mostly pleasure boats going through, and you described how that could be a funding issue, but is there some kind of moral failing around... I'm getting that from you, you know? What's what's the ethical issue that I feel you have with this being a recreational, fun thing to do, to traverse this?
Let me take you along with me as I'm standing at the Ballard Locks with Warren King George a couple of days ago. Hundreds and hundreds of tourists milling around, enjoying themselves. It's summer, you know, going down to watch the sockeye struggle through the fish ladder. They're having a great time. I mean, it's pretty entertaining, right? You've got these boats to watch, the fish to go see. You go back and forth the two sides. It's a jolly, fun place to be. You've got the tour boats coming through. You know, here's Warren King George's perspective. He's a Muckleshoot tribal member, and he said he used to be a fish counter at the locks for his tribe for 5 years. And he said, you know, I used to watch what we call shake and bakes, where the sea lions are shredding the adult salmon and the seagulls are eating the juveniles. He said, to us, those are our relatives. Those are our fish. And it was just horrible to watch. And he said there'd be days when he would talk to people and interact, and there'd be other days where really he just didn't want to say a word. It's just too hard to watch this gaiety, if you will, this circus that to him is a place of horrendous displacement and loss. And, you know, his point about the recreational traffic is, and for what? You know, it's not like, say, Grand Coulee Dam or the Columbia River Dams, where at least you have power generation for an entire region and beyond, all the way to the Western grid. I mean, in this case, what we wound up with is something a lot of people value, but recreational boat traffic, it wasn't the only way we could have that. And so to Warren King George and other Native people and even the rest of us, it's something to think about. You know, it's a lot was lost, an entire river, the migratory route of the native fish of this place, village sites, longhouses, sacred places, places of important spirit power. That is a lot.
It's a lot to wrestle with. For one thing, there's this, we have this, now it's become a caricature of an indigenous way of life before white settlement, that it was a life of subsistence and we don't think of indigenous people as having changed their environment, which is never really true, right? You're nodding. You can still see the fishing weirs, you know, right, in Lake Washington. We've always changed things. Humans have changed things to our liking.
Sure. Native people burned the prairies to keep the camas fresh and keep back the tree cover. They used fish weirs to trap fish. Technology was always part and is still part of their life whiz. And so, sure, people get oversimplified and drawn in black and white. There was a lot more going on than those caricatures reveal. But I think the other thing that really struck me in the reporting for this story was the presence, not the absence, the presence of Native people in this place today and the vividness of the connection. And by the way, the thriving presence of those people. Talking with Leonard Forsman of the Suquamish tribe, he's the chairman for the tribe, and he spoke beautifully, I thought, of how on certain days, if the light is just right, you know, you look across Elliott Bay and the urban waters and you can see the stories and the wisdom of his ancestors. You look at the Suquamish tribe today and, you know, they have their own language program, their own culture program, their own school, their economy is doing well and diversifying. Look at the Muckleshoot tribe, diversifying, thriving in a modern world, in a context that they have created with the benefit of treaty rights reserved by their ancestors, knowing that they would need a way to hang on in what was a new world. You look at the Duwamish people, not even recognized by the federal government. So the story isn't the same story. What is true is the persistence of Native people in this place in their own way. And I think that, for instance, going to the locks with Ken Workman from the Duwamish tribe, to hear him talk about feeling the presence, literally, physically, of his ancestors, their DNA, 10,000 years of burials still in the soil, he meant that. And watching his face, I know that he felt that.
Yeah, I've talked to tribal members who try to help me understand that this is not a matter of history to them, right? That industrialization and straightened concrete rivers and all that's just a blip.
Correct.
In the bigger story.
If you think about time, and you were to stretch a string across this room that we're sitting in, all the way from one side to the other, 15-foot long room, our presence, yours and mine, it would be the last little frayed end. We're tiny, we are a blip, and there was so much that came before, and there'll be so much more to this story. I think that it's really helpful to me, anyway, as I think about where we are now in time in the Pacific Northwest, to always seek to pull back the frame and see the bigger picture.
So what's the lesson? Should Seattle not have built the Ballard locks?
I love that question.
You love hate that question?
Yeah. I mean, if you're on the east side and you love zipping over to Seattle on a bridge rather than having to take the mosquito fleet, you know, probably you're going to enjoy that overflight by the F-15 fighter jets, you know, tomorrow celebrating the locks. If you're Ken, if you're Warren, if you're some of the other people that I talked to for this story, if you're Leonard, you know, not so much. I talked to the vice chairman of the Suquamish tribe, and he's been a fisherman all his life, and here's what he said. I wish they were gone.
By the way, why did the industrial boom on the shores of Lake Washington not materialize?
It's funny. The mills just didn't move from Ballard, you know, present-day Ballard. I don't know why that didn't happen. You know, you'd think, build it, they'll come. Somehow that just didn't happen. I mean, obviously we've got tons of development, but it's mostly residential today.
Are you going to tomorrow's commemoration?
I am not.
No? You won't see the Navy Boeing fighter jet fly over? You know why that is? Apparently that during the original opening ceremony, July 4th, 1917, a Boeing biplane circled overhead.
Well, there you go. Full circle. Yeah. I wonder what they'll do for the next 100.
But you won't be there.
I will not.
When you look at the Ballard locks, what do you think about?
Well, I'll tell you, for me, this is an unfolding story. I've been visiting the locks as a reporter and a resident of Seattle since 1992. And each time I've gone there, it's been for a salmon story, you know, about the sockeye run, which we actually planted there in 1935 just for fun. And actually, it is cool to be able to see the fish up close like that through a window. We don't usually get to see that. You know, as a reporter, for me, it's always been a fish story. This was the first time I was able to engage the human story of that place. And I learned so much, and it was really a privilege to understand where I was standing and what was there not long ago. And to understand that where there are condos today, those are burial sites. To think about the Black River, just to go back to that for a moment, the Black River today is a small wetland reserve. It's about 52 acres. It is surrounded by 405, a road that's actually called Monster Road. I'm not making this up. And the South Sewage Treatment Plant for King County. And yet it abides as a little wet spot. In times is the largest heron rookery in our region. So even today, it is a place of richness. And I find that instructive. You know, nature is the most powerful force and never wholly annihilated. Even now, you know, you look at the locks and Chinook salmon, they're now listed as a threatened species. You have this very sad situation where the endangered orcas are trying to make their meals out of threatened Chinook salmon, an endangered species barely surviving, starving, because they need a threatened species. And yet, Puget Sound Chinook do abide. They are still here. The sockeye, there hasn't been a sockeye fishery since 2006. The sport fishermen grieve the loss of salmon, as do the tribal fishermen. You know, we haven't had a sport fishery for Chinook in Elliott Bay in 10 years. So this is a landscape that is very challenged at this point to support the native wildlife that depends on it. And I think, you know, that's a lesson for us. It's something for us to think about, the costs and the benefits.
Seattle Times environment reporter Linda Mapes, are you going to the parade on Sunday?
I am not.
Okay. She'll be missing the historic schooner passing through the locks and leading a parade of historic vessels from Salmon Bay to Lake Union. But you're not against taking your kids or your out-of-town friend to the fish ladder?
Of course not. I mean, if anything, I would love to see more interpretive signage at the locks. A lot of people don't go into the visitor center, as cool as it is. There should, in my view, be much more about the native presence that was displaced, about the native wildlife that have been displaced and are struggling. This is the sort of thing that the Friends of the Ballard Locks and the Army Corps of Engineers, to their credit, have worked hard on. But I would like to see even more, because so many people go there. It is the third most popular tourist stop in Seattle, 1.3 million people a year. That's a lot of education that could be enriched. So I'd like to see that. I think it's always great for people to go outside and see the landscape. I'm for that.
Space Needle, Pike Place Market, Ballard Locks. One of them has an amazing, as we said, triumphant slash crushing story to it.
Yes.
And you can read Linda's piece about the 100 years of the Ballard Locks in the Seattle Times. We'll tweet that out now at KUOW. And you're doing a Facebook Live event on Thursday?
Right. So go on the Seattle Times Facebook page, and that'll be at noon. Bring your questions, rants, raves, whatever you'd like to bring up.
Linda Mapes, Seattle Times environment reporter. It's always good to see and hear you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
KUOW is The Record, coming right back.